Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. On the Valley Freeway's I-10 eastbound is closed at 35th Avenue due to an accident. You'll definitely want to avoid that area. Again, I-10 eastbound at 35th Avenue. Also an accident, I-10 eastbound at 75th Avenue. Looking for sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 83 degrees. Right now it's sunny and 81.
The Islamic State group known as ISIS claims a woman from Prescott has been killed in an airstrike by the Jordanian military in Syria today. The report has not been confirmed, and U.S. officials say they're looking into the report. But the news has shaken the friends and family of Kayla Jean Mueller, who grew up in Prescott. KJZZ's Steve Shadley spoke with her former co-worker today.
Tracy McConnell worked with Kayla Mueller at the Yavapai County Community Foundation a few years ago. They did volunteer work together, and Tracy says Kayla was a teenager at the time, and she says she was a person everyone looked up to.
Kayla, I mean, from the first moment I met her, bright, made for philanthropy her entire, I mean, as long as I've known her since she was a teenager. She's a community leader. She doesn't do it for acclaim. She does it because she sees powerful needs in the community. I guess I would really call her, what sums her up, as a humanitarian. I am so sad right now. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I understand. And you're doing great. I really appreciate it. And like I say, we're not completely sure what her future holds. We're not sure if the reports, these are reports from ISIS, that she was killed this morning today in a Jordanian airstrike, an act of retaliation.
She's a beautiful person. I just hope to God that's not true.
Yeah. What does this mean, even if this story amounts to hopefully the best, that she's still alive and still with us. What does this story mean to a community like Prescott in Yavapai County?
It means that there are shining bright lights in so many people here that will do whatever it takes to heal community. That's what she means. And we can't control what others do, but she controlled what she could do, and that's all we can do.
Okay. Tracy, I think we'll leave it at that. Is there anything else you'd like to say about Kayla that we should know?
My God, we've got to stop this stuff. We've really got to stop it, because these are powerful human beings who are doing great things, and they're being taken away. It's got to stop somehow.
Tracy McConnell speaking to us from Prescott about her friend Kayla Mueller. A purported statement by ISIS claims Mueller was killed today during a Jordanian airstrike in northern Syria. Mueller was being held hostage at the time by Islamic militants. Steve Shadley, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Salt River Project, the nonprofit utility which is not regulated by the Arizona Corporation Commission, is considering increasing costs for its customers who use solar power. If SRP's board goes ahead with the changes, that could lead to it hitting its rooftop solar customers harder than other utilities in the nation. The customers would see the difference on their April bills. Spokesman Scott Harrelson explains what SRP is exploring.
Future solar customers would all be required to be on this self-generation price plan. There are not additional fees. That is a misnomer. What there is, potentially, is less saving on your SRP bill. These rooftop solar customers will continue to save money on their SRP bill. There is a component to the price plan. It's called a demand charge. That demand charge is designed to give those customers, the solar installers, the industry, the price signals to adopt that technology in an appropriate fashion so that the customer is reducing their energy use during peak demand hours. And these price signals would incent the solar industry to apply these facilities going forward in a more efficient way. Look, we are not recovering our costs as a nonprofit public power utility. We have to recover those costs somehow. We're getting them from our other 985,000 customers. Mm. They're disproportionately paying for this small class of customers.
Scott, isn't this proposal potentially unfair to your current solar customers by adding a fee?
The proposal is that those existing customers will not be required to change to the proposed new price plan for 10 years. So 2025, they would be required to change to the new price plan. We believe 10 years is an extraordinarily long period of time. A lot can happen in 10 years. By 2025, we don't know what technology is going to be out there. We know SolarCity and these other installers, these leasing entities, have stated that battery technology is right around the corner, and they're going to be offering battery technology to their customers in the next 3 to 5 years.
People think of SRP when it comes to water and power, and APS just went to the Corporation Commission and tried something somewhat similar. I'm not going to say it's exact, but somewhat similar, and the backlash was not positive. Is SRP taking a risk here as far as perception goes?
There's no question that we knew this was going to be a difficult decision to make and a task ahead of us. We do care about our perception in the community. It's important to SRP, and we've worked hard to achieve that. But our obligation is to all of our customers. So when we talk about a class of customers, the 15,000 or so, and we have 985,000 other customers that we have an obligation to meet reliable, affordable electricity and water, we believe this is a leadership issue. We think it's an appropriate time to make this proposal. The price of solar panels is changing dramatically. They're coming down. We believe that the industry itself has said, we're ready to stand on our own 2 feet. We don't need incentives. We don't need subsidies. We agree. We think that this is absolutely the appropriate time, understanding that there's going to be some criticism.
Scott Harrelson, spokesman for SRP. One of the emphatic critics of SRP's proposal is Tempe City Councilman Colby Granville, who says it's a real problem.
I'm going to put up front $25,000, $35,000 to put in solar panels. I'm doing it because I want my $200 electricity fee to become a $100 electricity fee. And I know that over a period of right now 7 to 10 to 12 years, it's going to pay me back. And so it's, yes, I'm doing it because I want to save a little bit of money, but really I'm doing it because I'm a concerned, interested citizen. And I think this is the future of Arizona. It's the future of America and a whole bunch of independence things that we believe in generally as a culture. The economies of scale of solar panels are now becoming viable. And that's a problem. The problem is really simple. The problem is solar is no longer at a point where it has a 12-year payback or a 15-year payback. It's sliding to an 8-year or a 7-year or a 5-year. And I think what's happened with APS, and certainly what's happened with SRP as well, is they looked at it and they said, well, wait a minute. What if everyone started getting solar? That's not helpful for us.
But in your view, does SRP have a valid reason?
The legitimate reason is this, right? Is you have solar during the day, and you probably generate some electricity, you feed it into the system, and then at night you suck it back out of the system. And if your meter spins forward 100 and then back 100, your effective usage is zero. Because SRP only bills you for your usage, they bill you $0 for the month. Meaning that even though they had to build the power plant, even though they had to put in the transmission lines, and even though they had all these capital infrastructure costs, they have no way to recover those costs. And so their solution is simple. We're going to generate a sort of line fee, and we're going to charge you a line fee. And that line fee right now is about $50. The difficulty is the way they're setting it up and the amount that they're charging, solar's dead. Solar ceases to exist in residential in Arizona in SRP markets. And so what that means is this market that we have nurtured and dumped money into and dumped technology into and understood as a basis of our future as an economy effectively goes away for the residential distributed model.
What do you think would make SRP not go this direction? Does it have to be like a public shaming?
They've been a good partner for Tempe for decades. There's a problem they have to fix. I just don't think this is the solution to that problem. If you said, you know what, it's not about that individual producing solar, but it's about the economy that we live in and the air we breathe and the energy independence that we have. And so instead of dividing the number of solar fees by the number of solar users and coming up with a dollar amount of $50, if we were to say, let's divide the number of solar users by our total number of users, now you're talking about 70 cents per user per month. And the conversation that it's disappointing that we haven't had is if SRP came to me or you or I think most of their users and said, look, we've got a burgeoning economy here and we've got new economies of scale. We don't know when the time may come, but right now, would you be willing to chip in 70 cents so that, for lack of a better term, this industry can exist?
Tempe City Councilman Colby Granville. After hearing from the public, SRP's board is expected to vote on the new pricing plan on February 26th.
We step back out on the ledge now to check in on the goings-on at the state capitol. And joining me out here today is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Howie, how's your balance today?
Well, I'm planning on jumping if things don't improve.
So this was a pretty busy week at the state capitol. Lots of interesting bills going through the process, not the least of which is a bill that would basically do something that State Senator Steve Farley has been trying to do for quite a while, which is ban texting while driving.
Well, sort of. And here's the deal. What he got this year is he proposed a full texting ban. But here's the political problem. He can't get that out of the Senate. So what he had to settle for was a bill that says you cannot send a text, but you can receive a text, you can read messages, you can look at your GPS, you can input the coordinates you want and the street address you want, you can dial your phone. So it's kind of a stripped-down version, which may have a better chance.
And if you are driving and presumably not writing a text, there's a decent chance coming up that you might not get a photo radar ticket, right?
Well, this is another perennial battle. Cities have decided they'd like to keep them. The question becomes, A, are they fair? And, well, that depends on whether you've been issued one of the tickets. And, B, you know, do they really replace the police officer? Because you don't have really the discretion. You hit 11 miles over, you get a ticket. The bill that got out would, in fact, tell cities no more photo enforcement. Now, here again, there may be a compromise in the works. Odds are this bill will end up being amended before it gets out. Do we end up banning photo radar at the city level? Hard to say at this point.
Another perennial issue at the Capitol is that of guns, and this week there were a few gun bills that were introduced and came up for debate, right?
There are several of them. The one that got out of a House committee this week does an additional preemption on the rights of cities. Lawmakers thought they had everything tamped down. It says cities can't have their own gun laws or regulations. Well, Tucson decided that if you're going to use our facilities to have a gun show, we're going to require that you do background checks for the person-to-person sale of guns. There are a lot of folks who say, well, that's not fair, that's not right, it really isn't effective at keeping that out of the hands of criminals. So they've added some language into a bill that says cities cannot regulate the transfer of firearms. They already can't regulate the sale and storage, so this is designed to close what gun advocates call a loophole. The more far-reaching one is this perennial fight of whether guns should be allowed in public buildings. Now, you may say, well, they're not allowed now. You know, I'm not talking about the courts and the places where you have the metal detectors, but you go into the library and there's a sign on the door and it says no guns. The law requires the library to make lockers available. The argument by folks who support Second Amendment rights is only the law-abiding people obey that. And if you've got a miscreant who walks in and wants to shoot up the library, they're not going to obey that. So if you're a law-abiding citizen, you should be able to defend yourself by bringing your own gun. They say the only way around that is make sure everyone is disarmed, which means metal detectors and security guards.
Howie Fisher is Capitol Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
You're very welcome.
There's an effort to get more women to lead businesses and business schools, but a lot of pressure comes with the responsibility.
When you're kind of the first of something, you need to make sure that you're not going to be the last.
That's just ahead on the show.
Good Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In traffic, eastbound lanes of I-10 have reopened at 35th Avenue, although there is still some slowing. Also, the ramp connecting I-10 eastbound to the 17 northbound remains closed. Still probably want to avoid that area. 81 degrees at KJZZ at 219.
KJZZ is supported by the annual Willow Historic Home Tour, featuring architectural styles ranging from Tudors to bungalows built downtown in the 1920s. 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday, February 8th. Tickets at willowhistoricdistrict.com.
The NFL estimates an economic impact to the Valley from the Super Bowl of around $500 million, but getting an actual calculation can be difficult. We have two perspectives on what the big game and all the related activities will mean for the Phoenix area's economy, starting with the director of the Arizona Office of Tourism, Sherry Henry.
There's a couple of different metrics that are in play. The first metric, two of them just actually came out. One was the initial Phoenix Metro visitor spend. Let's call it that, over Super Bowl weekend was $206 million. That's just the spending. That doesn't take into account any of the indirect or induced, so that's not the economic impact. Arizona State University is going to do their impact study. The last Super Bowl around in 2008 was about $500 million was the economic impact. The combination of the Pro Bowl, the Super Bowl, and the Waste Management Phoenix Open, we're estimating, just those of us that have been doing this a long time, it's probably going to be about $700 million economic impact to the Phoenix metro area as well as the state of Arizona.
How many of the people who came for any of those events basically replaced people who would have been here anyway? This is obviously the height of tour season in the Phoenix area. So was there an issue of replacement visitors as opposed to, you know, having a big event here in the middle of July or August?
What was interesting about it, the first metrics that we received, we actually got from Smith Travel Research, which measures the occupancy and the average daily room rate and the profit back to the hotels. This measurement for Saturday night was one of the highest Saturday nights in the year, even including March, for the Phoenix metro area. It far exceeded the same time period last year. It's a great indicator of the fact that these were new people. You know, I know there's been some discussion about that, but we really believe that these people that came, and it's certainly verified by these numbers, they came for this event.
When you look at the impact of an event like the Super Bowl and the Pro Bowl and the Phoenix Open and all, how much of it is short-term impact versus long-term impact?
Well, obviously, the visitor spending and these wonderful high occupancy rates are immediate. And so that's immediate money that is being pumped into our economy. Then again, you take the indirect and the induced, that's your economic impact. But I think what's really important to remember is that this is not something that ends today. It didn't end this Monday after the Super Bowl. We had over 70 CEOs on the forum that was put together by the Super Bowl that brought CEOs from around the country, around the world, to showcase Arizona. From the tourism perspective, this is such an amazing opportunity to showcase the wonder and the diversity, not only of Arizona, but particularly the vitality of the Phoenix metro area. We are showing that to the world, and we really believe that puts Arizona in a different level, and it makes people recognize that Arizona is a world-class destination for whatever it is that you want to do.
I'm interested in what you said about how, you know, people see what Phoenix and the Valley and the state are all about. And I'm wondering, are there people out there who, like, don't know about the Grand Canyon, who don't really know that it's nice here in the winter? I mean, how much education of that sort of thing do you have to get to people, you know, living in other parts of the country about what Phoenix really is versus what people already know about Phoenix?
We did some research last year, which basically shows that if people have been to Arizona, they have a 92% positive rating that they would plan to come back, tell family and friends. The Grand Canyon obviously speaks for itself. But this events like the Super Bowl, this shows a whole different side of Phoenix Metro and the state, because people realize now that there's many, many more things going on here than just the beauty and the Grand Canyon.
Sherry Henry is the director of the Arizona Office of Tourism. Some economists, though, say the estimates from the NFL and Super Bowl host committee are overblown. Rob Bondi is an economics professor at Lake Forest University in suburban Chicago and studies the economics of sport.
Typically, the NFL estimates the economic impact of the Super Bowl somewhere between $500 million and $700 million. And most of us who do dispassionate, objective research on the subject have found that if you move the decimal point one place to the left, you're far more likely to provide a more precise estimate on what it is that the Super Bowl provides in the way of economic impact. Of course, it varies from location to location. It's very important to consider not only what it is that the Super Bowl provides in the way of spending by those coming to a host city, but you have to take into account how spending decreases as a consequence of hosting a Super Bowl.
That's a pretty big disparity between what the NFL estimates and what some economists estimate. I mean, what makes that disparity so big?
Well, if you think about doing a primitive analysis that would, let's say, identify the additional economic impact by measuring the number of people that attend a Super Bowl and related events times the number of days they stay, times the amount of money they spend daily, you would have a primitive measure of economic impact. What economists who study the question also consider would be, how does the Super Bowl detract from economic activity? And it detracts by discouraging people that might otherwise come to a city. In addition to that, you've got to consider activities that people do not attend as a consequence of the event.
How much of the impacts are short-term versus long-term impacts?
Well, I think that's pretty much exaggerated, too. I think that people are already aware of Phoenix. It's not as if it's a surprise city.
So assuming that the numbers that economists come up with and estimate are accurate, that the overall impact is somewhere between, let's say, $50 and $70 million, is it worth it for a city to host a Super Bowl?
Well, if you think of the amount of money involved in hosting, recent reports indicate that those numbers may be $100 million. So if you're going to do rational economic analysis, you have to think about what it is that you could do with $100 million spent on hosting the event. And so I can think of lots of things that cities can do with $100 million. So you could make the argument that if the Super Bowl does indeed bring in $600 or $700 million and it only costs $100 million to put on the event, then sure, go ahead and host. But again, I think I would be very suspicious of $600 or $700 million benefit figures. And I would also emphasize that it does cost something, and something significant, to host. And we often just ignore the costs of hosting, but those have to be considered as well if you're going to make a sound economic decision.
Rob Bondi is an economics professor at Lake Forest University.
Corporate America has a dearth of female presidents and CEOs. That shortage also applies to business school deans, who are likely to influence that next generation of young women as they look to take the big steps into leadership positions. Amy Hillman has been dean at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business for a couple of years. She's one of only 10 females in the U.S. who hold that title.
I was surprised at the level of visibility placed on the fact that I was the first female dean at W.P. Carey. And just like in the top of corporate America, there are very few female CEOs. There are very few female business school deans.
Is this because there are fewer women who go into business school? Is this because, are we still making up for generations where women were not encouraged to be in this sort of business?
I think the answer is complex. First, I think that we are about on parity right now for women and male in terms of undergraduates majoring in business. But then typically you go out to work for 4 to 5, 7 years before you would get your MBA. And what we're seeing there is a dramatic decrease in the number of females versus males in MBA programs. And then if you think about investing another 4 to 5 years on top of that to earn a PhD, we have significantly fewer women entering the pipeline to become professors.
Do women in your position then have to be leaders for that next generation? And is there pressure to be in that position and almost in some ways be seen as a pioneer?
Yeah, I think there is. I think we have an obligation. I think that, you know, when you're kind of the first of something, you need to make sure that you're not going to be the last. And so a lot of attention is paid to how we can start to make progress. How can we encourage more women into the pipeline to become faculty members, just the same way that we encourage young women to go into the pipeline to get to the top of their corporate careers.
Now, there are 10 women who head business schools across the country. Other than being females, do the 10 of you have something special in common? But do you have different approaches? Do you have different philosophies?
Well, it's interesting. So 10, it sounds like a very small number, and it is. We're still probably 12% of business school deans. And so we were together recently, and one of the things that we found so inspiring about being together was sharing kind of the visibility, the challenges, and the benefits that come along with being a female dean in a business school. So some things that were very similar, 9 out of 10 come from the discipline of management. And when you think about what a dean is like a CEO, a manager of a business. And so perhaps that's not surprising, but we seem to have a much greater number of deans coming up through that track.
How real is the glass ceiling today? Has the glass ceiling gotten a little clearer, a little easier to break in the past decade, 2 decades?
I think it's definitely improving, but I think most women would agree that the improvement has been slow.
Do you think that businesses will be run better if women are seen as being more equal to men, whether it's because they've come out of business school or because they've been inspired by you or some other female dean? How vital is that to changing the business climate?
I think, you know, the answer is irrefutable. Any organization performs better when there is gender diversity. Diversity is really the key to opening up creativity, to getting the right kind of answers. Women are now over 50% of the active participants in the workforce. And what we need then to do is see that reflected at each level so that we don't become more insular in decision making.
Amy Hillman, Dean of the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. She'll be part of a panel called Gender Matters next Tuesday in San Diego at the Dean's Conference for the Association to Advance Collegiate Schools of Business.
Horse racing has been known as the sport of kings, but its popularity, like boxing's, has leveled off in recent decades. That hasn't extended, though, to people who like to place a wager every once in a while.
The Arizona Department of Racing is trying to make that even easier by authorizing telephone account wagering or phone betting for Phoenix-based Turf Paradise. If you're someone who likes the pageantry and atmosphere and walking up to the window to talk to the cigar-chewing guy who takes your wager, phone betting may not be for you. Vince Francia is Turf Paradise general manager.
Instead of having to come to the racetrack or to go to one of our off-track betting facilities here in Arizona, they will be able to make a wager over their telephone.
Now, is this going to help Turf Paradise? And if so, how?
Phone betting will help Turf Paradise. We have track records from 37 other states which already have it legalized. It increases the handle. The handle is the wagering. And by increasing the wagering, then the track is able to offer better purses to the horsemen. And in this particular sport, the horses are everything. If you cannot put horses on the track, then essentially you don't have a sport.
Listen, bet $10.
$10?
$10!
I bet $10.
$10, right.
They're off! The race is over! You lose.
Vince, you've been involved with this for a couple of decades. So if it isn't about the gambling, why do you love the sport?
The horse is a very endearing creature, a very passionate animal. And when they race out there, it excites you to see them, and that's even if you don't have a bet.
Vince Francia, he's general manager at Turf Paradise in North Phoenix.
Still to come, the state's facing a big deficit, but how does that affect Arizona's counties?
We have no tools to increase revenues. We have no way to pass on our budget problems to others as the state does.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. This is 91.5 KJZZ. In Valley traffic, watch out on I-10 eastbound at Central. A collision blocks the center lane. Also I-10 eastbound at 27th Avenue. A collision there is blocking the right lane. Expecting a warm weekend around the valley. Partly to mostly sunny skies and highs both Saturday and Sunday of around 82 degrees. It's currently mostly sunny and 81 at 235.
Expanded local coverage of arts and culture, early childhood, and healthy aging is made possible by support from Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. U.S. intelligence sources say there is no evidence to support a claim that an American has died in a Jordanian airstrike against a terrorist stronghold. This after the so-called Islamic State said that a young woman kidnapped while in Syria to help war victims died in a building collapse following Jordanian attacks. NPR's Martin Costi has more on the American in question.
She's a 26-year-old American. She's a humanitarian worker. She was working in Syria, in Aleppo, when she was captured in 2013, and she's been held ever since by ISIS or ISIL. Other people who were captured with her at the time were all eventually released. She was the last one being held.
National Security Council spokeswoman Bernadette Meehan says the White House is deeply concerned by the reports, but has not seen evidence to support the claims. New government figures show a gain of 257,000 jobs in January. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has more on a very positive jobs report.
The Labor Department said there were more jobs added the last 2 months of the year than previously reported. Wages also increased in January, and more people rejoined the labor force. When the job market remains troubled for a long time, some workers get discouraged about their chances of finding work and simply stop looking. They are no longer even considered unemployed and aren't counted as part of the workforce. But when hiring increases, more people come back into the workforce, which temporarily increases the unemployment rate, as happened last month. The jobless rate ticked up to 5.7%. Though some sectors, like energy, are slowing down, economists say this report is a good sign for 2015. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow closed down 60 points at 17,824. The Nasdaq lost 20 points, closing at 4,744. This is NPR.
With Arizona facing multi-million dollar budget deficits for the rest of this fiscal year and the next one, many areas of government are facing cuts. Arizona's counties have been dealing with costs being shifted from the state to them for several years and would do so again under Governor Ducey's proposed budget. But Navajo County Attorney Brad Carlyon, president of the Arizona Association of Counties, says the proposal is much milder than many in county government had feared.
It is something that for this coming fiscal year will find a way to survive. But the concern is the camel getting its nose under the tent in more areas. You have to look that it's been 6 years of shifting the state's budget problems onto the counties. The state has a multitude of tools at its disposal to try to deal with its financial crisis. The county has none. We have no tools to increase revenues. We have no way to pass on our budget problems to others as the state does.
Do you think that elected officials on the state level pay enough attention to what elected officials on the county level are dealing with on a day-to-day basis?
There needs to be a comprehensive overview of county finances. Because not only is there the disparity in the property taxes, you also look at state shared sales tax revenue, which is actually the biggest part of county budgets. Only one small part of that formula is population. They also look at where was that tax generated from. You take a small county like Navajo County, our shopping options are Walmart. We have in Sholo a JCPenney. But where do our population go for most of their big dollar items? They go over to Coconino County and Flagstaff, where they have the big mall and many shopping options, or they come down here to the Valley or Tucson. So our tax dollars are being spent, our income from our citizens are being spent outside, and we're not seeing that come back, creating another disparity between the counties, but yet we all have to provide the same services.
Are there other proposals in the governor's budget that are particularly concerning to you?
Coming from a criminal justice perspective, asking the counties to pick up 25% of the cost of juvenile corrections concerns me on a number of issues. And we saw when Governor Brewer, I think about 5 years ago, talked about shifting the cost of juvenile corrections directly under the counties, the counties reacted by reducing the number of juveniles that we were sending to juvenile corrections anyhow.
You mentioned that this budget proposal from Governor Ducey was less bad than what you had anticipated, but counties have been having costs shifted to them as the state has been dealing with budget problems for several years now. So I guess I'm curious, in general, what is the state of county finances in Arizona?
There's a number of counties that are on the edge of the fiscal cliff. The last 6 years, from what the state does directly in their budget shifting costs, and what they also do that we don't take a strong enough look at, is new legislation that creates new functions and mandates that counties must do that have just escalated the cost of doing county business.
Brad Carlion is the Navajo County Attorney and President of the Arizona Association of Counties. For another perspective, we turn to Kevin McCarthy, President of the Arizona Tax Research Association, which calls itself the taxpayer's watchdog.
The governor faces extraordinary challenges in Arizona to manage the ebb and flow of the economic cycle, with revenues increasing and decreasing, because over time, over the last 20, 30 years, voters in Arizona have stripped the governor and state lawmakers of a lot of budget authority. So it's not an exaggeration to say that both the governor and the legislature have various sets of handcuffs that they have on them to manage budget deficits, and we're facing a significant one.
It's interesting that you mention handcuffs that voters have put on state lawmakers, because in many respects that's basically the same analogy that counties are using to describe what the state is doing to them as far as shifting costs and then restricting ways that counties can raise their revenue. What do you make of that argument?
Well, it's a complicated issue, and I'm sympathetic to the county's concerns generally. We're not fans of cost shifting just to try to hoodwink taxpayers about the real costs of government that they're paying and who's imposing costs on them. But in fairness to the governor, and I think the counties would probably concede this, that we have a very complicated and intertwined public finance structure where the relationships between the county and the state in particular are very, very strong. For instance, the state raises substantial amounts of revenue in the state taxes that we pay, both in sales taxes and income taxes, and then turns around and distributes those back to county governments and to city governments, for that matter. By the way, what's going on right now is not at all uncommon. There's very few budgets that are passed where there isn't minor tweaking in the relationship between state government and county government, and some degree of cost shifting or finger pointing about who's doing what to whom.
One of the concerns, though, that counties are raising is, in addition to the cost shifts, that the state is placing restrictions on the ways that counties can potentially raise their own revenue as far as caps on taxes and things like that. Do you think that's appropriate for the state to do, to be telling counties you just can't do some of these things that maybe you need to do?
I don't know of anything in the governor's budget where the governor is simultaneously, or the legislature for that matter, saying we're going to shift costs for you, and then we are going to further limit your ability to access revenues. Now, Having said that, counties don't have independent authority to do much of anything. They're administrative arms of the state, and they are limited in what they can levy in property taxes, how much they can access in sales taxes. And parenthetically, Mark, we do a lot of work with county government and know county budgets quite well. They're in much better financial position than the state of Arizona is in 2015.
Kevin McCarthy is president of the Arizona Tax Research Association. New numbers from the group Polaris show more than 5,100 cases of human trafficking came into its texting helpline and the National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline nationwide last year. The majority of those cases involved sex trafficking. For a look at Arizona's numbers, we turn to Jenna Novak, program specialist with the National Human Trafficking Resource Center. And Jenna, what did you find about the level of activity in Arizona last year?
So in 2014, there were 288 calls that came in from Arizona, and of those calls, 77 cases of trafficking were reported.
How did that compare to the previous few years here?
So last year, in 2013, we were able to identify 66 cases, so there were 11 additional cases that came through this year. And then the year before that, there were 58. So we're seeing a steady increase in the number of cases that we've been able to identify the last couple of years.
Do you think that's due to more trafficking happening here or more awareness and more reporting of the cases that had been happening?
I think it absolutely has to do with more outreach that's going on. Individuals, community members are more aware of what trafficking looks like, what the indicators are of trafficking, so that they can start to identify potential trafficking situations. I also think that it has to do with service providers and task forces getting the hotline number into the public and into the appropriate hands so that individuals know to call the hotline when they need some kind of assistance.
So do you think that there's a way to actually gauge whether or not there is more or less trafficking going on, given that things are changing due to people being more aware of this issue?
Prevalence for trafficking is incredibly difficult because it's such a hidden crime. So it's really hard to say whether or not trafficking is actually increasing. I can say the calls into the hotline and the cases that we're able to identify are 100% steadily increasing every single year, but I can't say whether or not that's due to an increase in trafficking occurring. I think it definitely has to do with community members being more aware of the issue and the hotline number being out into the public.
How do Arizona's number compare to those of its neighbors?
Arizona is in the top 20 states for number of calls that we get that are coming through the hotline. So in 2014, there were a total of 5,042 cases, and of those, 77 cases came from Arizona. So it is, you know, out of the 50 states and all of the territories that we cover, it is a large number of cases that have come through.
Why do you think that is?
I think that Arizona, especially this past year in 2014, has done an excellent job of putting together task forces, getting coalitions together to start doing some of that outreach. People in Arizona have been aware of trafficking for a while, and those that are behind the scenes have really increased their level of engaging with the community to build awareness.
So given the way that the numbers rise with more awareness and the number of cases reported rises with more awareness, at what point do you say what we're doing is working and we're actually really making good progress here?
I really think that we're trying to focus on getting the numbers out to survivors. So when we're seeing an increase in our callers being directly from victims or survivors that are looking to get connected, then I think that that's where the impact is made, and that's where we can say that we're assisting people. The other thing that we do is we do training and technical assistance with service providers and law enforcement that are out there. So we really see ourselves as a connector. When people call in, we're getting them connected to the appropriate people.
Jenna Novak is a program specialist with the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, which is run by Polaris.
About 25 years ago, at the end of the Cold War, McDonald's opened its very first restaurant in the USSR capital of Moscow. It was a huge occasion. The restaurant served more than 30,000 people on its first day alone. The BBC's Mike Lanchin reports.
It's January 1990, and the Soviet capital, Moscow, is still a city of endless queues and food shortages. Canadian businessman George Cohen is there, about to make history.
We turned the corner, and there were thousands of people on a cold, gray, dismal morning in Moscow, waiting in line to get into McDonald's.
Cohen, founder of McDonald's in Canada, had been working towards this big day for more than a decade.
I said to the policeman, well, when are you going to let the barricades down to let them in? He said, oh, 9 or 9:30. I said, why don't you let them down now? He smiled and he said, you move the barricades. And so my boys and I moved the barricades, and those thousands of people slowly walked toward the restaurant.
I think it's time we open this restaurant. What do you think? Let's cut the ribbon. Как вы думаете, пора открывать ресторан?
First day, we served 34,000 people.
I was working kitchen. It was crazy, absolutely, like lots of running and shouting.
20-year-old Sveta Polyakova had been chosen from among more than 27,000 applicants for a job at the shiny new restaurant.
For Soviet people to hear, please come here and place your order and thank you and come again. These words, they were so rare in the Soviet service culture.
But, says George Cohen, convincing the Soviets to allow McDonald's in had taken years of hard bargaining.
You know, who would we see? Anyone that would say, come and have a meeting. Initially, we were talking about serving food at the Olympics in 1980, and we thought we had a deal for that. And when they finally called me in, they said, we can't sign the deal. The highest level of government, there was a huge fight that took place between two of the powerful people there. One said, it'd be good for us to get McDonald's in for the Olympics, and the other said, it'll show that we can't do the food service. It's an embarrassment.
But once the reformist Mikhail Gorbachev took power in the Kremlin, George soon secured the deal. And in January 1990, McDonald's opened its doors for the very first time in the Soviet capital. Sveta Polyakova quickly rose up the company's ranks. And today, she's head of PR for McDonald's Russia.
Having McDonald's come into this country, that was a sign to the people that there may be a lot of opportunities and a lot of hope.
So McDonald's was like a symbol of democracy for you, and still is.
And still is.
That's the BBC's Mike Lanchin. When people think of Arizona landmarks, the first things that come to mind are usually the Grand Canyon, Red Rocks, and even Meteor Crater. But you may not think of its waterfalls. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us to one in the West Valley.
Many look forward to a rainy day in the valley to make the drive to the White Tank Mountain Range. Sure, it has more than 25 miles of trails for hikers, horseback riders, and bikers, but the attraction flows much deeper than that.
So we're going to walk up that way?
Yep, it's a mile up.
Did you know there's a White Tank Mountain waterfall that cascades down about 80 feet?
Well, it's created by rain runoff, so after a good rain is the best time to try to come and see the waterfall.
White Tank Mountain Ranger Jessica Bland is my tour guide. I've been waiting weeks to see it, so after a recent overnight rainfall, I thought this would be a good time to visit.
Winter rains, in my experience so far, seem to produce better waterfalls than the summer monsoon rains. We definitely have waterfalls after the summer monsoons, but the rain is coming so quickly that the waterfall comes and goes very quickly as well.
The trail to the waterfall is lush with Sonoran desert landscape, including shrubs, trees, and wildlife. The rain has stopped. The clouds hover over the mountain peaks like cotton candy. The canyon rock formations become clear, and our voices begin to echo.
We're getting there, aren't we?
Need a hand at all?
Ooh. Look at this.
All that's left is a trickle of water slowly making its way down over the white granite rock to the small pond below at the end of the trail.
It's always a treat to be able to see a waterfall in the desert, even if it's occasional. But White Tank has a lot of history We have evidence of several different Native American cultures that lived in or came through this area.
Land says the waterfall was a reliable source of water for wildlife and people who lived here for thousands of years. It's evident in the petroglyphs found on the way to and near the waterfall.
Coming back here into this little canyon area, we see evidence of somewhat of a fault line. So geologically, there was a lot going on. But then also the rain runoff has created this area here in the basin where the water is retained.
Land says natural catchments, like this one at the bottom of this waterfall, are referred to as tanks. She says there was a large one in the area, used as a water stop along a stagecoach route in the mid to late 1800s. And seeing that this mountain range is mostly granite and maintains its white color when water falls through its canyons, the area was called White Tank Mountain. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things that we ought to know, please let us know about them. Send us an email, theshow@kjzz.org. Tonight is First Friday, which means lots of art in downtown Phoenix. One show that'll open with the festivities is called Old Blue Eyes is Back, featuring the work of part-time Valley resident Fred Teakin. I met up with him at Mon Orchid Gallery, where his art is being shown, and asked him where he draws his inspiration.
I have the luxury of looking at a blank canvas and exploring a lot of different things. I will paint over a lot. I have a direction that I want to go, and I'm looking, stand back, take a look at it, and all of a sudden, it seems to maybe want to go another direction, so I just follow that, and I just let it happen, and it usually works out fine.
In what way, if any way, does being here impact your work?
Well, I think a lot of it has a kind of a Southwest flavor to it, just for the fact of all the bright colors and everything I use. I'm a Chicagoan, and I've been here for 30 years, so I'm almost a native, I would say. It's a different type of lifestyle, so I think that my color is what I pick up from this area, along with the vibrant art scene downtown, which, if it wasn't for that, I would probably be looking at this stuff in my living room, you know, so.
Do the messages that you try to convey in your art have any relation back to Phoenix or the Valley or Arizona?
I have some. Actually, I have a show starting in Palm Springs that has the pink Jeep tours, and it's got all kinds of cactus, and I have sold some paintings that are definitely Southwest influenced and Phoenix influenced, but at the same time, just something just leads me in that direction. So I don't like to go in with too many preconceived ideas, like I'm going to paint a cactus or something, because if I do, I usually get myself in a jam.
How important is it to you that your art has a message and isn't just fun and interesting to look at?
I'm not really a political person, but sometimes my art just takes me in that direction. So I guess when I see what's going on, it takes a much more impact than I would think I have inside me. But some of it gets pretty radical, and so I don't know quite how to answer that, but I feel like it's more powerful if there's a message, even when it's humorous.
Artist Fred Teakin's show opens tonight at Mon Orchid Gallery on Roosevelt Row in downtown Phoenix. It runs through the 27th. So, Steve, you and I have both lived in our homes for a little while now. Do you remember when you were shopping what it is you were looking for?
Mark, I'm the opposite of a handyman, so I wanted a place that was not going to break down right away.
But did you consider your home's resume?
No. Why?
Well, let us take you on a tour of an apartment that used to have a completely different purpose.
Welcome to this 8-foot by 40-foot navy blue shipping container.
So right now we're in the living room.
That's Brian Stark. He and his business partner, Wesley James, own the architecture company Stark James. They're now the owners of
16 containers from Long Beach.
Stark and James plan to transform these containers into an 8-unit apartment complex called Containers on Grand, because they'll eventually be moved to a lot on Grand and 12th Avenues.
It's hard to know exactly what the containers were used for before this, but they definitely did a lot of traveling, carrying cargo across the ocean.
And now they're ready to try something new.
So are the more than 100 people who have shown interest in them.
But I thought they were still empty.
That hasn't stopped people like Stephanie Strouser from getting on the wait list. She says she's always had an eclectic style.
I like things that are kind of like not cookie cutter, kind of out of the box.
So she's thinking outside of the box by going in the box.
So I just kind of like things that are a little different and artsy. I kind of like where my home is like a piece of art itself, you know?
And the project developers say most of the people on the wait list are like Strouser, young professionals with no kids who are looking for a unique living experience.
Unique I get, but how about the cost?
Right now, they're estimating around $1,000 a month for rent. Stark says they're saving money on the fabrication by keeping the character of the containers intact.
We worked really hard trying to get all navy blue containers so that they match, and our goal is to do something that's relatively low maintenance.
So no paint on the exterior, and they're also keeping the original plywood flooring. The team got the necessary building permits this week and will start on fabrication soon.
The containers should be starting their first day on the job as apartments in late spring.
Yeah, we're not getting anything.
Lots of good stuff to do this weekend around the valley. For example, the Street Eats Food Truck Festival is this weekend. That's at Salt River Fields at Talking Stick in Scottsdale, 11 to 6 p.m.
Call a sitter so you can attend.